On March 1, 1992, a referendum was held on whether Bosnia should become an independent nation, in which all citizens and groups would be treated equally. The result was an almost unanimous approval of independence, but only two-thirds of the electorate voted. Karadzic had ordered the Serbs to stay away from the polls, and most of them did. By then, Serb paramilitary forces had begun killing unarmed Muslims, driving them from their homes in Serb-dominated areas in the hope of carving up Bosnia into ethnic enclaves, or cantons, by force. This cruel policy came to be known by a curiously antiseptic name, ethnic cleansing. The fighting and killing raged throughout 1992, with European community leaders struggling to contain it and the Bush administration uncertain of what to do and unwilling to take on another problem in an election year, content to leave the matter in Europe's hands. In the summer of 1992, as television and print media finally brought the horror of a Serb-run detention camp in northern Bosnia home to Europeans and Americans, I spoke out in favor of NATO airstrikes with U.S. involvement. British Prime Minister John Major attempted to get the Serbs to lift the siege of Bosnian towns and put their heavy weapons under U.N. supervision. At the same time, many private and government humanitarian missions were launched to provide food and medicine, and the United Nations sent in 8,000 troops to protect the aid convoys. By the time I became president, an arms embargo and European support for the Vance-Owen Plan, dividing Bosnia into a series of ethnic cantons, had weakened Muslim resistance to the Serbs, even as evidence of their slaughter of Muslim civilians and violations of human rights in detention camps continued to surface. In early February, I decided not to endorse the Vance-Owen Plan. On the 5th, I met with Prime Minister Brian Mulroney of Canada and was pleased to hear him say he didn't like it either. A few days later, we completed a Bosnian policy review, with Secretary of State Warren Christopher announcing that the United States would like to negotiate a new agreement and would be willing to help enforce it. On February 23rd, UN Secretary General Boutros Ghali agreed with me on an emergency plan to airdrop humanitarian supplies to the Bosnians. On the next day, in my first meeting with John Major, he too supported the airdrops. They would help a lot of people stay alive, but did nothing to address the causes of the crisis. In April, a team of U.S. military, diplomatic, and humanitarian aid personnel returned from Bosnia, urging that we intervene militarily to stop the suffering. On the 16th, the United Nations accepted our recommendation for declaring a safe area around Srebrenica, a town in eastern Bosnia where Serb killing and ethnic cleansing had been especially outrageous. On the 22nd, at the dedication of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel publicly pleaded with me to do more to stop the violence. By the end of the month, my foreign policy team recommended that if we could not secure a Serbian ceasefire, we should lift the arms embargo against the Muslims and launch airstrikes against Serb military targets. As Warren Christopher left for Europe to seek support for this policy, the Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic, hoping to avoid the airstrikes, finally signed the UN peace plan, even though his assembly had rejected it just 6 days earlier. I didn't believe for a minute that his signature signaled a change in his long-term objectives. At the end of our first 100 days, we were nowhere near a satisfactory solution to the Bosnian crisis. The British and French rebuffed Warren Christopher's overtures and reaffirmed their right to take the lead in dealing with the situation. The problem with their position, of course, was that if the Serbs could take the economic hit of the tough sanctions, they could continue their aggressive ethnic cleansing without fear of further punishment. The Bosnian tragedy would drag on for 2 more years, leaving over 250,000 dead and 2.5 million driven from their homes, until NATO air attacks, aided by Serb military losses on the ground, led to an American diplomatic initiative that would bring the war to an end. On May 19th, on the advice of David Watkins, who was in charge of administrative operations at the White House, and with the concurrence of the White House Counsel's Office, Chief of Staff Mac McClarty fired the 7 employees of the White House Travel Office. The office makes all the arrangements for the press when they travel with the president and bills their employers for the cost. Hillary and I had both asked Mac to look into the travel operations after we had received complaints about it. After an audit by the accounting firm, KPMG Pete Marwick turned up an off-the-books ledger with $18,000 not properly accounted for and other irregularities, the employees were dismissed. I had forgotten all about the travel office until the firings were announced. The reaction of the press corps was extremely negative. They liked the way they had been cared for, especially on foreign trips. And they'd known the people in the travel office for years and couldn't imagine they'd do anything wrong. Many of the press felt the travel office staff virtually worked for them, not the White House, and felt they should have at least been notified, if not fully consulted, as the investigation proceeded. Despite the criticism, the reconstituted travel office provided the same services with fewer employees at lower costs to the press. The travel office affair proved to be a particularly powerful example of the culture clash between the new White House and the established political press. In early November, the Congressional Quarterly reported that I had enjoyed a higher success rate with Congress than any president in his first year since President Eisenhower in 1953. We had passed the economic plan, reduced the deficit, and implemented many of my campaign promises, including the earned income tax credit expansion for low-income working families, the empowerment zones, the capital gains tax cut for small business, the childhood immunization initiative, and student loan reform, which cut the cost to both students and the taxpayers. Congress had also approved national service, the Russian aid package, the motor voter bill, and the family leave law, under which a worker could take a little time off when a baby was born or a parent was sick. Both houses of Congress had passed versions of my crime bill, which would begin funding the 100,000 community police officers I had promised during the campaign. The economy had already produced more private sector jobs than had been produced in the previous 4 years. Interest rates were still low, and investment was up. The only problem was that the American people didn't know about any of this. I did some serious thinking about the trouble we were in. It seemed to me that the roots of the problem were these. The White House staff had too little experience in and too few contacts with Washington's established power centers. We were trying to do too many things at once, creating an impression of disarray and preventing the people from hearing what we had actually accomplished. Our lack of a clear message made otherwise minor issues look as if I were governing on the cultural and political left, not from the dynamic center I had promised. The impression was being reinforced by the one-note Republican attack that my budget plan was nothing but a big tax increase, and I had been blind to the considerable political obstacles I faced. I knew I had to change, but just like everyone else, I found it was harder to change than to recommend change to others. Things were soon looking up when the House passed my budget, 219 to 213. Then the Senate took it up and immediately scrapped the BTU tax in favor of a 4.3-cent a gallon increase in the gasoline tax and more spending cuts. The bad news was that the gas tax would promote less energy conservation than the BTU tax. The good news was that it would cost middle-class Americans less, only about $33 a year. In the third week of July, I appeared on Larry King's show from the library on the ground floor of the White House to talk about my battle for the budget and whatever else was on his and his callers' minds. Like everyone else, I liked Larry King. He has a good sense of humor and a human touch, even when he's asking tough questions. About 45 minutes into the program, things were going so well that Larry asked me if I'd do an extra 30 minutes so we could take more questions from the viewers. I agreed immediately and was looking forward to it. But at the next break, Mac McClarty showed up and said we had to end the interview after an hour. At first, I was irritated, thinking my staff was worried that I might make a mistake if I kept going. But the look in Mac's eyes told me something else was going on. After Larry and I wrapped up the interview and I shook hands with his crew, Mac walked me upstairs to the residence. Holding back tears, he told me that our lifelong friend, Deputy White House Counsel Vince Foster, was dead. He had left the Rose Garden after an appointment ceremony for FBI Director Louis Freeh, driven out to Fort Marcy Park, and shot himself with an old revolver that was a family heirloom. Vince and I had been friends virtually all our lives. Our backyards had touched when I lived with my grandparents in Hope. We had played together even before Mac and I started kindergarten. I knew Vince had been upset with the travel office controversy and held himself responsible for the criticism directed at the counsel's office. He had also been wounded by questions raised about his competence and integrity in several Wall Street Journal editorials. For whatever reason, Vince came to the end of his rope. In his briefcase, White House counsel Bernie Nussbaum found a note that had been torn into little pieces. When put back together, Vince's note said, "I was not meant for the job in the spotlight of public life in Washington. Here, ruining people is considered sport. The public will never believe the innocence of the Clintons and their loyal staff." Vince was overwhelmed, exhausted, and vulnerable to attacks by people who didn't play by the same rules he did. He was rooted in values of honor and respect, and uprooted by those who valued power and personal assault more. And his untreated depression stripped him of the defenses that allowed the rest of us to survive.